to learn more about what's happening. We have a federal threats web part of our webpage that actually is meant to compile a lot of the resources that exist related to navigating this really challenging and chaotic time, you know, with this federal overreach and these federal attacks. That's all in our website, pretty easy to find. We've also got a solidarity calendar that we maintain at the Oregon AFL-CIO website location. That is a place where we try to post all the actions that are happening throughout the community. We're right around the corner. Tomorrow is May Day, International Workers' Day, and so there'll be a lot of actions that we're both supporting and engaging in, both in Salem and in Portland. And I think, you know, keep an eye on some of the most active labor organizations and community partners. I always think of PACOON, Oregon's Farm Worker Union, who's been a really important ally in farm worker justice and somebody who we consider a real, you know, critical ally and friend. They do incredible work, and their social media channels and online presence is a great place to look. SEIU 503 and 49 and AFSCME, Oregon AFSCME's web pages can also be a great resource. But when I think about that question, it's like, who are the trusted partners in society? And when I think about those trusted partners, it's the Basic Rights Oregons of the world, it's the PACOONs of the world, and it's the labor partners of the world, just to name a few, who can really sort of help inform and stay, you know, keep people connected to the struggles and the threats and the real challenging time that we're going through right now.
Okay.
Well, Brother Trent, I'd like to thank you for participating in our interview today. And I'd like to thank you for ensuring that Oregon residents have a unified way of tracking the national chaos. Thank you for the creation of the Oregon Labor Dispatch and the monthly virtual meetings tracking the federal threats that are happening to us, seems like, every day.
You bet. It's an honor to be with you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
I just like to announce that the Coalition of Black Trade Unions, we meet the second Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. We have suspended our face-to-face meetings and are utilizing Google Meet to conduct our monthly meeting. Our next meeting will be held June the 10th, 2025, and our address is orcbtu10@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you, so join us in our evolving adventure of representing Black union workers. We'd like to announce that Portland's 20th annual Dr. Charles Drew Blood Drive and reception at 9 a.m. honoring Charletta Malone, the executive assistant of on June the 21st at the Portland Blood Donor Center located at 3131 North Vancouver Avenue. Hours for blood donations are from 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thank you, Brother Trainer.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll say holla.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we're talking with Chris Yadon, the managing director at SAPRIA, about the issue of childhood abuse and trauma and how that affects incarcerated individuals and the good work that SAPRIA is doing to try to help specifically women who have experienced childhood trauma and sexual abuse while they're incarcerated. Chris, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Hey, so good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. So let's start off. First of all, can you tell me what is SAPRIA?
Yeah, SAPRIA, at the highest level, we exist, or we go to work every day to liberate individuals in society from child sexual abuse and its lasting impacts. So when we say liberate individuals, it's about healing. It's about mitigating the impacts of child sexual abuse and the the lasting impacts it has on individuals. When we talk about liberating society, that's more focused on our prevention work, helping reduce the likelihood that child sexual abuse will happen at all, as well as raising public awareness around the issue of child sexual abuse. Still a taboo topic in our country in many ways, and we're working hard every day to break down those walls, if you will, and eliminate the taboo behind it.
Chris, I see that CIPRI is a nonprofit that's dedicated to helping support survivors. It's adapted its trauma-informed curricula into a course that's designed to help incarcerated individuals in the process of trying to cope with strategies for recovery. So you're pretty busy helping out over 6,000 incarcerated individuals. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so one of the best ways I could describe the partnership is at CIPRIA, we are experts in the issue of child sexual abuse. ADOVO are experts in delivering curriculum within prison and jail facilities. And so together in that partnership, we bring our expertise to the table, they bring their expertise to the table to make our curriculum available to currently individuals who are incarcerated within women's prison facilities specifically. And I'll just give you the latest numbers. As of this morning, we've had over 19,000, because we believe individuals matter, so I'll be exact, 19,054 individuals complete at least one of our 10 modules through ADOVO, through that tablet platform. And we've had over 8,000, so 8,546 to be specific, who have completed all 10 of the modules that we provide through the ADOVO platform.
Great. That's really wonderful. So Chris, can you explain how the CIPRIA and ADOVO partnership came together, and what gap is it aiming to fill in the prison system?
Yeah, I'll use a little bit of analogy because I think the analogy paints a really, really beautiful picture of this partnership. So you're familiar with bamboo. Most people are aware of what bamboo is, and bamboo has a really interesting story in that the first 3 to 5 years of its life, it's establishing a root system, and you don't see any real external growth. But then somewhere after that 3 to 5 year establishing period, within 1 to 2 months, it grows as high as 100 feet tall. So people sometimes look at that and go, wow, how did that happen overnight? Well, that's 5 years of work that produced that tremendous growth. And that's very much how I would describe our experience. We've done work since 2019 with different prison and jail facilities to try to figure out how do we provide curriculum, meaningful, helpful curriculum for survivors of child sexual abuse. And frankly, it was planting a lot of roots and a lot of learning for us, a lot of curiosity, a lot of figuring things out. And lots of stops and starts. COVID was not great for our learning process. But through all that, we were able to figure out what the right way was to enter this particular area and to help individuals who are experiencing incarceration. So our partnership with ADOVO, we launched 5 months ago. So those numbers I shared with you, the 19,054 women that had completed at least one module, that's just in the last 5 months. And so it's very much like that bamboo shoot that's shooting up. So I could make it sound like, you know, it was this match made in heaven that we just kind of figured out and it just worked. But actually there's a lot of effort to get us to this point. And we were introduced to ADOVO through another partner, the Compassion Prison Project, who had worked with on a piece of curriculum. And through that networking, through those partnerships, we just found something that was mutually beneficial that we believe is going to be extremely beneficial in the long run for those experiencing incarceration.
Thank you. Given the staggering rates of childhood sexual abuse among incarcerated people, especially women, why do you think it's taken so long for trauma-informed resources like this to become widespread in prisons?
Yeah, to answer that question, we really have to go to what trauma-informed means. One of the core tenets of being trauma-informed is putting control or power back in the hands of those who experienced the trauma. And you think about that in context of our systems. That is very counterintuitive to the way our systems operate. So our systems are about exerting control over those who are incarcerated in terms of punishment or as an act to keep them from harming others or even harming themselves, right? So you have these control power systems that are pushing on it. Trauma-informed care says, no, you got to give power back to the individual. So navigating through that makes it particularly difficult. Another thing that makes it particularly difficult is for an individual to benefit from trauma-informed care, their stress systems, their survival systems have to calm. When we're in a hyper-aroused state or a hypo-aroused state, it's really hard for us to engage in any type of healing. And so prison systems are such that individuals in those systems develop intense hypervigilance because of the environments they're in. So even if you are approaching with trauma-informed care, the potential for them to benefit from it is inhibited because they're in those stress responses far too often for far too long. A couple other kind of nuances that make this particularly difficult is this is considered from a research perspective, those who are incarcerated are considered a vulnerable population. And so there has to be extra care in researching practices that are used with this population specifically. And that's appropriate, right? We should use care. But particularly within prison systems who are adverse to research anyway, it really slows things down and almost grinds it to a halt. So it just takes more time to get best practices and trauma-informed approaches into the system. And then lastly, I would just call out the reality of community dynamics, trauma-informed care. I love the way our chief clinical officer says it. She said, trauma happens in isolation, but healing happens in community. So, you know, because of the community dynamics in prison systems and some of the difficulty that comes with those dynamics, providing safe healing communities within that system can be particularly challenging. So those are some of the obstacles. All of them can be dealt with, all of them can be overcome, but it's just slow, calculated, deliberate work.
Thank you. Chris, how does this trauma curriculum differ from other rehabilitation or education programs typically available to incarcerated individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question. I want to acknowledge where my expertise is, which is in child sexual abuse. I'm not an expert in incarceration. I've learned a lot. I'm learning a lot. So I'm going to answer it from my point of view, from my perspective as an expert in child sexual abuse, of what makes us different and what I believe makes us different in this environment. The first is our approach is what's called a psychoeducational approach. This is a major gap in the mental health community. Most mental health care follows our Western medicine that's used in physical health, which is diagnose, treat, diagnose, treat, diagnose, treat. What we found, though, with particularly with trauma, is psychoeducation plays a much bigger role in the treatment planning and the development of that treatment planning than it does in other types of medicine. Meaning, it's really, really important that we slow down and take the time for the individual to understand why they are experiencing the symptoms they're experiencing. And the driver behind that with child sexual abuse specifically is there is an intense amount of shame and stigma that comes with child sexual abuse. And there's a lack of information for survivors of abuse such that they don't equate their symptoms that they're experiencing to their childhood trauma. They don't connect those dots. And until they connect those dots, I'm going to use words they were used, not my words. They're like, I'm broken. I'm crazy. Like, something is wrong with me. Once they have that psychoeducation, that narrative starts shifting because they're like, oh, this symptom, my panic attack, let's say, or my emotional numbness is a result of my trauma. It no longer is a label defining me as an individual. It's something that happened to me. So that psychoeducational approach is really, really important. And we emphasize that. In fact, our entire curriculum in our partnership with ADOVO is a psychoeducational curriculum. It is not a therapeutic modality. It's a psychoeducational curriculum. The other thing is we do extensive program outcome research. And like I said earlier, that can be particularly arduous in any environment, but particularly in prison and jail systems. And we've done research since day one to explore outcomes. So not only do we use evidence-based approaches to inform our curriculum also is validated and or shifted based on our program outcome research. Last thing is that makes us different is we are focused, passionate, I don't know what other word to use other than focused, passionate, driven to scale a solution. Most implementations in prison systems or otherwise are micro. They're very small and community-based. We're focused on the macro. How do we reach the masses? Which also really highlights the partnership with ADOVO. And that is, can we figure out how to have impact at scale? And that's something that separates what we do.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Prison Pipeline, and we're talking with Chris Yadin from Sapria. Chris, thanks so much for letting me know about that. What have you heard directly from participants about how the course has impacted their healing, especially with the constraints of prison life?
Yeah, so this is still a work in progress. Like I mentioned a little bit earlier, this implementation specifically is only 5 months old. So we did a lot of focus group research in the 5 years leading up to this. And we heard a lot of similar things to what we hear in our survivor population that's outside of the prison system or jail system. And that is, I don't feel alone anymore. That's the biggest one by far. I don't feel alone anymore. I don't feel crazy anymore. Finally, things make sense to me. I've got a long road ahead of me to figure out how to manage and heal from this, but I feel like I finally have the tools. Those are some of the most common things that I've heard. Specific to feedback we receive from women in our pilots in the prison system, there are some unique things we heard from them. Specifically, the one that stands out to me the most that was a common or themed pattern was, this is the first time I feel like someone has believed me and actually cared enough about me to help me. Everybody else just, you know, for whatever reason, wanted to blame me for everything that went on in life. And, you know, they're quick to take accountability. I don't want to minimize their accountability because I think a lot of individuals experiencing incarceration have a strong sense of accountability. But they also are quick to recognize that their circumstances contributed to their current situation. And I think when they acknowledge that, particularly child sexual abuse, it's like, when those dots connect, that is huge for them. in terms of being able to move forward.
I believe that incarceration often re-traumatizes survivors. How does the program navigate the reality that healing is taking place within a prison?
Yeah, so the curriculum is not specifically designed to address re-traumatization in the system. However, every principle in it is applicable to re-traumatization in the prison system. We are very narrowly focused in focusing on how to manage and work through the trauma they experienced as childhood. And we have strong biases and beliefs based on research, but strong biases and beliefs that so much of today's challenges that they're experiencing, the symptoms they're experiencing are rooted in that childhood experience. So if we can get to those roots, we can solve a lot of the downstream issues. But it would be ignorant for me to say they aren't facing day-to-day traumatization issues, because they certainly are. And so the practices that they learn, particularly some of the body work we introduce, some of the mindfulness practices we introduce, can help them navigate their day-to-day environment, even though its intention is actually to deal with their childhood experiences.
Can you speak to any resistance that you faced from prison administrators, correction staff, or policymakers in implementing this program? How's it been going with that?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest point of resistance, I'll say it's been surprisingly positive overall, but the biggest point of resistance we've experienced is the wait and see resistance. It's no one wants to go first, right? So I commend some of our brave, thoughtful, forward-thinking administrators in the Utah State Prison System, in a youth facility also in Utah, in two facilities in California, and one out east, and even one in the country of Colombia as we were testing an international implementation. Each of them had the courage to say, hey, we'll go first. And they were all part of our pilots. So that's the key, is you have to get someone to go first. That's the biggest point of resistance. And then you have to have good research to follow. So even right now with our Adobo implementation only being 5 months old, we have great output measures. So, you know, how many people are taking the courses? What is their completion rate? That starts to give us information. But even as we sit right now talking about this, we're still relying on the promise of our outcome measures outside the prison population to inform what's happening in the prison population. And this year, 2025, is when we're doing the outcome research to look at things like post-traumatic stress symptom reduction, coping efficacy improvement within the prison system itself. So that's a current initiative. We're excited to see what are the differences, what's the same, is there something revolutionary that we're learning. That for us is the last major barrier that prison systems or prison administrators specifically are looking for, is that outcome data before they follow lead. So that's been the biggest issue. And kind of like I highlighted earlier, everything's just slow. So progress is being made. People are open to us. They're open to the discussion. Progress is just, it's at a snail's pace. That's the biggest barrier.
How is success measured for this course?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we measure impact through two things. One side of it's scale, and that's how many people we can reach. And then we look relative to that scale of those people that we were able to reach, what percentage have a statistically significant positive outcome? So that positive outcome we're talking about is where we specifically look at a reduction of post-traumatic stress symptoms. So we use specific measures that are well-researched, well-vetted to measure that, both before and after. We also look at coping efficacy, which is the ability to deal with those symptoms when they do surface. So when you put these together, you're like, okay, can we reduce symptoms? Yes or no? If so, how much? Can we increase their ability to deal with symptoms when they do surface, yes or no, and how much? And then that combined leads to what we kind of look at as our hallmark outcome indicator, which is what are referred to as well-being or life satisfaction indicators. So how did the intervention impact their overall well-being or life satisfaction? So outside of the system, those numbers that say for one of our interventions is 37% reduction in post-traumatic stress symptoms, 19% increase in coping efficacy, leading to a 45% overall well-being improvement, right? So we'll use that same formula as we're doing our measurement this year within the prison system to see how the intervention plays out.
Thanks. We're talking today on Prison Pipeline with Chris Yaden from Sapria, which is a nonprofit that helps incarcerated individuals in women's prison deal with the effects of childhood trauma and sexual abuse. Chris, this program had been available 10 years ago. What kind of a difference do you think it would have made?
Well, wow, that's... if you'd asked me that 5 months ago, I would have given you a very different answer, because I wasn't expecting the scale to take off at the speed it did. So I'm going to, in real time, shift my answer and my expectations to your question. When I look at our past 10 years, we had over 30,000 individuals sit in a seat participating in a program. And a little over half of those were specific to healing programs. So using that as a comparison, we've already reached more people in 5 months through this one implementation and partnership than all our other programs combined over the 10-year history. And we were doing pretty darn good, right, before this. So to me, as I look at this, I see the potential to reach hundreds of thousands over a 10-year period. I would, dare I even say, reach over 1 million individuals over a 10-year period. With the specific implementation we're doing, I expect to see reduction in post-traumatic stress symptoms, improvement in coping efficacy, which will improve their overall well-being, like I mentioned below or before. I believe, and this is going to take a lot of time and energy to research, I believe we have a big opportunity to restore dignity to individuals who feel like their dignity has been stripped away, right? They get to feel human again when so many of them had something so critical taken away from them in their childhood. So restoring that dignity, I see 10 years from now, not only restoring dignity, but the ability to reintegrate, reenter the world and contribute. I see reduced recidivism. I see improvement in family systems as they can approach their families and loved ones in a more healthy way. I think the benefits are going to be tremendous. I hope 10 years from now we get to have another conversation and I can tell you what happened, not what I think is going to happen.
Chris, if people would like to find out more about this, the partnership between Sapria and Idovo, or if they'd like to find out more about you and your work, I know that you're a speaker and you talk on issues related to childhood sexual abuse. Where can they find out about all of this information?
So I'll give you a few spots. Sapria.org is an easy spot. A quick search for Idovo or incarceration on our site is going to pull up a blog for them. They can learn about
how do you spell that. How do you spell that, Chris?
Yeah, it's spelled Saprea, Sapria.org.
Great,
so that's a great place to go. If you want to follow some of my personal work, I'm a recent adopter of Substack. I'm doing quite a bit of writing on there. My last name's unique enough, spelled Yadon. You'll find it C Yaden on Substack. You're going to find my work. I talk a lot about the issue of child sexual abuse in general. I talk a lot about emotional numbing, one of the major symptoms of it. Talk about prevention work. How do we reduce risk for our kids? There's several good topics that I address there. so they can follow me there. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. That's another place people can connect with me. So sapria.org or one of those two spots to connect with me directly. I'd love to interact with folks.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Well, it's been a real pleasure having you on Prison Pipeline talking about this exciting new development in the treatment of trauma and abuse that people have experienced as before they're going into prison, to help them heal from that.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been so good to be with you.
Thanks so much, and have a good night.
You too.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host at KABU. We prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the